session number 27075, Reel 18.
Squadron Leader, Reel 18. Squadron Leader, you were mentioning the first German raid and watching it on December the 18th, 1941.
Yes.
What happened next? Obviously, there would have been a change in operations with the Germans arriving back.
Yes, I don't recall that there was any particular change. I think we... I think we'd simply carried on much as we had done, getting ourselves ready in the morning and going up to take over the readiness shift. Certainly, I think this would have been the case until they started hitting us personally, when no doubt we began to take a bit more notice. It was always expected that Grand Harbour was an important target to both the Germans and the Italians, because it was from Grand Harbour that so much damage was being done to Rommel's supplies in North Africa. And I dare say it came as a bit of a shock when we at Takali suffered our first bombing raid from the Luftwaffe. First one I recall distinctly was, for some reason, two or three of us wandered up to the airfield late afternoon. I'm not too sure why, but we did. And as we did so, a barrage just to the north of us opened up. And we watched this for a while, and three Ju-88s emerged from the barrage smoke, and almost instantly were hit by AK-AK, and two of them, one came down vertically and exploded, the other one glided down, or appeared to glide down, and crashed in a small field just to the north of the airfield. And the third one thought better of it and scuttled away northwards. So that was really quite heartening for us. We thought, well, if the guns can do that, we're in a healthy position.
Could I ask you a little bit about the anti-aircraft defences of the island? Do you consider they were strong, or were they good defences?
I'm sure they were. What the statistics were, I don't know. And undoubtedly, it's all recorded. Just what impression the AK-AK had. I think, generally speaking, AK-AK was regarded as more of a supporting role. Over Valletta, where there was what was claimed to be the biggest anti-aircraft barrage in the world, I think it's true to say quite a few aircraft were knocked out of the sky, but not all that many. And I've always had the feeling that certainly heavy AK-AK fire was more of a deterrent than a particularly potent defensive weapon. Light AK-AK, on the other hand, I think can be very dangerous. It's very, very easy to get pipped when you're flying low and you don't see whatever it is that's going to shoot at you until it's too late. And once you've been hit and you're flying at low level, if you control the damage at all, then you don't have very much chance of getting out.
Was it low level ACAC that hit the German aircraft that were coming in?
No, that was heavy ACAC. I don't know what height they're at. I'm trying to picture them. But no, it was heavy. By light ACAC, of course, I mean the Bofors gun. And you could always see their... You could always see their fire going up. ACAC, first you'd see would be the black puffs. Well, you see a flash and the black puff filling the sky.
Was the aircraft, the airfield itself, defended by specific batteries?
There was a Bofors gun just to the west of the admin building. And the ones that, the ACAC that hit those 288s simultaneously, that was just located just north of the airfield, but not all that close. So, yes, they would have been deployed in the defence of Jakarta airfield, but at some little distance from it. And I can only recall that one Bofors gun, just west of the airfield. There were machine guns later on, but they were in pairs of Lewis guns, and they sighted a few of those here and there. But certainly, there didn't appear to be any great concentration of guns around the airfield, specifically to defend the airfield. I think it was more a case of all the guns that were on the island were deployed in such a way as to give the biggest possible cover to the airspace generally. I think that's the way it was.
You say you were heartened, obviously, by the defences working to such good effect.
Mm.
What did you feel then, obviously, about the Germans starting to target the airfield?
Yes, well, the first one was... we were walking. We were walking up to the point of view, I think, when we heard the noise of aircraft and looked up, and we saw quite high up a formation of three aircraft. And we couldn't be too sure whether they're 88s or Heinkels or what they were. We thought they were 88s. And as we watched, they came straight across towards us and realised they were enemy. And so the three of us, and we hopped into a slip trench. And at the same instant, I saw the fighter escort milling around them, or at least I thought that's what I saw. And in the event, I suddenly realised they were bombs. They looked like aeroplanes at first, but they were bombs. And moreover, they were coming down straight towards us. And, yes. And so we burrowed even deeper into our slit trench. And before long, there was the most tremendous uproar. And a whole stick of bombs went right across. Two fell just to the... west of us. Two fell just to the east of us, and two more fell further away. I'm not sure they went a couple more after that. So it was a stick of bombs, a rather wide open stick that they'd put down. And that was the first very personal encounter I'd had with enemy bombs attacking our airfield. After that, of course, it was a regular event. And from the day the Spitfires arrived, it was almost an hourly event.
You mentioned that you dived into a slit trench. Was there trenches or air raid shelters provided across the airfield for such an eventuality?
There were slit trenches dotted about. There was one shelter. After they'd built our stone brick crew room, they built a stone brick ground shelter there. And while we were away, one afternoon, we were aware, I think we were swimming at Sleema, and we were aware of a raid on Takane. Now we went at Sleema, we'd gone to the cinema, and there was a raid on Takane. And when we got back, we discovered that this stone-built surface shelter behind the crew room had taken a direct hit. And there were a lot of troops in there. I think about 12 or 15 killed in there. That was the most serious incident we had on the airfield, as far as I'm aware. But no, there weren't all that many shelters dotted around at all. In fact, as I said earlier, we didn't seem really to get to grips with the necessity to defend and protect everything as far as we could. They were busy on the west side of the airfield, where the hill sloped up towards Mdina. They were busy building underground, well, we thought they were underground aircraft pens. They were burrowing into the hillside. But somebody said, no, they're not wide enough for aircraft. They're just for general stores, ammunition and what have you. But that was the only really visible sign of any big activity taking place to make any elaborate defences. The biggest lack of all, certainly in my day, was aircraft blast pens. Now, later on, as you'll have read in Fortress Europe, everybody, every man, Jack, was given a shovel and the job of filling sandbags and building blast pens, because this was the only way that one could preserve the aircraft when they were standing on the ground. But it certainly didn't happen during my time in Malta. It was only afterwards they really got to grips with the problem of what can happen to airfields that aren't properly defended.
You mentioned earlier the kind of terrain in Malta.
Mm.
Would that have an effect on, obviously, a bomb dropping? Because you mentioned a hard, stony, rocky place.
Mm, it is, yeah.
Does that affect bombs in the sense of, I was thinking, do they explode on surface?
Yes, they would. It was a softish stone. I always thought it was sandstone, but I read it's limestone. So it was a softish limestone. But big stone, it would tend to splay outwards. In the desert, of course, a bomb would penetrate into the top surface before exploding. And so somebody had the bright idea of putting sticks on the nose of the bomb, so that it was a stick about so long, so that the stick would sink into the sand, and then the percussion cap would blow the bomb.
And who would repair damage to the airfield when it occurred?
Later on, the army, I think, practically took over that role. Our own troops would turn out and do a certain amount of the work, but the army were enlisted largely to do that because, I mean, let's face it, there were 30,000 army on the island. Apart from the anti-aircraft, not a single soul to shoot at. So it didn't make sense to have all these chaps not doing anything at all. And indeed, not to be unkind to the army, but they had to be fed. And getting food to the island for them was an extremely expensive business. When I've got upstairs, I'll bring it down. So, we've got the Luftwaffe back now. And most of the time they were going for Grand Harbour and any shipping that might be in there, particularly warships or submarines, And apart from one or two isolated incidents involving Takali, we were not hit too hard until April, when the Spitfires arrived. Ironically, that was when the Germans decided to pay more attention to Takali.
Can you give me an idea of how the Spitfires arrived and what the process was of them arriving on the airfield?
Yes, it was very good. There were 15 of them, and they flew off Wasp, not too sure which carrier, and their progress from the carrier to the island was being monitored all the way. And as soon as they were within range, we would go out to meet them. And as we approached the island, we slipped to a side. And the Spitfires arranged themselves in three VICs of five each, five aircraft in each VIC, close formation. And they came in from the southwest corner, flew right across the island, low level in formation, and out across Valletta Harbour. And the Maltese practically went mad. They knew the score. They knew that the Hurricanes were having a tough time against the 109Fs, which were very good aeroplanes. We're losing a lot of aeroplanes and a lot of people. That's some of them. And they just rushed. They almost instinctively knew and rushed down to the streets, and waving and shouting, "Spitfire, Spitfire!" And they landed. The Hurricanes landed back at Lucca, and the Spits came to Cali. And they'd only been there a few hours when the first raid came in. And did a lot of damage. And the Spitfires weren't really effective until the next lot came.
How much time would it take the Germans really to organise that type of a raid on the airfield? Because they were obviously aware that the Spitfires had arrived.
Mm,
What's the kind of flying time between Sicily and Malta?
Oh, it's only 60 miles. Most of the bombers came down from Catania. The fighter escorts from Comiso and Gela. So Catania would be... hour and a half, if that. Not very far away, they could be with us. Their organisation is very good, mind you. They had got plenty of time, because that convoy would have been coming in from Gibraltar for a couple of days, and being attacked all the way. So they had got plenty of time to get themselves organised. Well, now, whether they knew that there were Spitfires, I don't know. I think they probably did, because well, they always insisted that our Hurricanes were Spitfires in it anyway. They'd never, a German would never admit he'd been shot down by a Hurricane. That was the last possible thing that could happen. If he did, it was the biggest disgrace. He'd probably be posted.
You'd landed away at Lucca, and that what was Lucca like?
Well, no, I didn't personally. I was on the ground. I didn't go on that trip. Lucca, well, it was a big busy airfield with lots of Blenheims and things about. I think the Wellingtons used to come and go, if they could be spared, I think. But it was a big busy place. I was only there two or three times. On one occasion, Takali got waterlogged, so we had to go and operate from Lucca. It was never very well organised. The business of getting the troops and their equipment and everything over there from Takali, it was always a bit laborious. And we'd only be there for a day or two, and then we'd have to shift it all back again. But two times I was at Lucca under not very favourable circumstances. First time was the one where I got shot down over. About 15 miles, 20 miles, I suppose, from the island out to east. And I bailed out over the island. And then later on, not too sure when, it's in there. And we were scrambled from Lucca, we're operating from Lucca, we were scrambled. And we'd taken off, we were halfway around the circuit when my engine stopped. And I think we were probably about 800 feet. Something like that. Now, fortunately, I was just within reach of Lucca, just. And I thought I might make it with wheels down, but then I could see it wasn't going to happen. I was just going to have to lob it down on the edge of the airfield, which I did. It bent the propeller, of course. And unfortunately, there was a huge coil of barbed wire around the edge of the airfield. I didn't see this until the last moment. And it was like being enmeshed in a spider's web. These great big coils they have with barbs on. And the whole thing just sort of wrapped itself around me. Anyway, they got me out of it. And the medical officer insisted on giving me a full medical. I said, I've only forced landed with the wheels up. He said, the book says that after an accident of any kind, pilots are to have a full medical, in full medical. And that includes blowing up the mercury, which we know you chaps hate. You'd have thought he got something better to do. So I had this full medical. Was declared fit for flying.
How did the Hurricane hold up to that kind of forced landing? Because you mentioned, obviously, in the UK, a similar occurrence. Mm. But what about the landing on that kind of terrain? Mm. How did it hold up there?
Well, it was the barbed wire checked it, you see. It was like... it was like going into a spider's web. It just checked it. Before I really got enmeshed, it hit the ground. The aircraft hit the ground, bounced like that, and shot forward. And then there was the wire there, and It only went a little way forward and stopped.
Was there much damage to the aircraft?
Well, obviously it was a new prop required and a new radiator. I don't know how much damage would have been done to the wings by all this wire. It could be that it just pierced little holes here and there. Hopefully it wasn't too much. But I think probably by that time we got so many damaged hurricanes about the place needing repairs of one kind or another. I don't know how much priority they gave to that one. It wasn't a very good one. Otherwise the engine would have kept going.
Was there any kind of, well, investigation as to why the engine had stopped?
Whether they'd have bothered at that stage, I don't know. Now, when was this? Okay.
Yep.
On February the 23rd, in Hurricane 612, my engine failed immediately after takeoff. This was caused by a conrod shearing and going through the crankcase. So I had no option but to crash land the aircraft on Luca. And I see I put taking the barbed wire fence with me, which brought the aircraft to a standstill.
Was there a problem with spares for the Hurricanes? Because obviously you've been operating them for some time on the island at the time.
Yes. Well, I think probably by that time there were so many damaged Hurricanes that there was no shortage of spares, although Sod's law would be that it's the bits you haven't got that you need.
Had they been operating okay? Were there very few mechanical problems with the Hurricanes during that period you were on Malta?
No, the Hurricane was pretty good. It didn't have a bad record. Tom Neal would say differently. Tom Neal had 5 engine failures. And he hated Hurricanes. He said it was one of the worst airplanes ever built, Tom would say. But, no, it wasn't a bad airplane.
You'd had a lot of experience with Hurricanes, though, hadn't you? All of your experience.
Oh, yeah, I got more to come. I got a whole tour in the Western Desert on Hurricanes. So, it was a pretty serviceable aircraft. It was well built to start with. I know that because I built it. It was well built, well designed, perfectly satisfactory for the job for which it was designed, up to a point. And it was able to cope admirably against anything the Italians or the Germans could put up until the advent of the new Daimler-Benz engine, which gave the 109 a huge, totally new lease of life. And indeed a new lease of life to the Italian Mackie. But up to that point, the Hurricane had been good, and it went on giving very good service. We had virtually no trouble in the Western Desert with our Hurricanes. And the job we were doing was suitable for the Hurricane. So, no real complaints, not from me anyway. Tom would say differently.